The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla as we glide into fall. Layla, how are you doing?
I'm okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good, very good. So for our novice listeners, every week we do a Q&A session with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. It sort of replicates a situation that happens in our office where we have kind of a 1-2 punch where I see patients from a medical standpoint, of course, with some nutritional insights included, and then they head on down the hall for a comprehensive diet history and for specific nutritional advice from our Hoffman Center nutritionist, who is duly trained as a registered dietitian and also possesses a master's degree in the field of nutrition. And every week we do a duet based on your questions. You can send us questions directly via radioprogram at AOL.com. One word, radioprogram at AOL.com. Gets your questions to our attention, and we reserve the rights to edit your questions or to be a little bit selective because some of our questions go beyond the scope of a simple radio answer. So make your questions concise and on target and of general interest for our listening audience, as many of you have, because we had some great questions recently. So yeah. Are you enjoying the fall?
Yes, I love fall weather. Don't you?
Oh,
sweaters and boots season.
Yeah, it's really, you know, I have to say, this morning, got up early and looked at the, you know, because in a Manhattan apartment, you have to kind of look at your computer to find out what the weather is. You could stick your head out the window. But so, you know, and I noticed that the temperature was like, you know, a nice 60 degrees. So I said, Wow, great. You know, this is going to be a great morning for a run. And I have to say, you know, put on my running shoes, went out there in just shorts and a T-shirt. And it was just perfect running weather because, you know, I have, over the summer, I've slogged through so many runs where it was like hot and humid and oppressive. And now it just, you know, the only thing that holds me back is, you know, lousy stamina. You know, that's no other excuse.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of, you know, heat conditioning or, you know, some sort of hot weather ordeal. So it's really great. And you know, that's one of the reasons why all the big marathons are this time of year. Chicago just had their marathon.
Right.
And New York's going to have one in a few weeks.
November 1st.
Yes, it's a great time of year.
It's supposed to be November. You know, that's right around the time of daylight savings time.
Yes, yes,
I wonder
indeed.
If that's going to throw some people off kilter.
You know, actually, I think a couple of times what's happened is they've had like a double whammy. I think the days, well, wait a minute, is it you fall, you spring forward and you
fall back.
Yeah, actually, fall back is a good thing
because
it gives you gain an hour. So actually, those poor people who, and I remember doing the marathon many years ago, back in the 90s, you got to get up super early because you get literally get on a bus in Manhattan at some ungodly hour, and then they deposit you at the starting point, which is Staten Island near Fort, whatever the heck it is out there, and you sit, and you basically sit, and it's that time of year, early in the morning, it's cold, so you basically sit and shiver, and you're nervous, and you're not sure whether you're trembling because you're nervous or because it's cold. And then, you know, you wait, and you finally, you know, after an hour and a half of just waiting. I mean, actually, there were prayer groups there. I remember people praying before the race.
Really? Wow.
And there was one gigantically long trough. It must have been like 50 yards long, which was a pee trough for the males.
Uh-huh.
It's easy on guys. They just have to have a long trough in order to go to the bathroom. Women need like, you know, individual outhouses, but so I don't know if they still have it that way.
Porta-potties,
but it was kind of a droll situation because like thousands of runners, you know, just taking that one final, you know, farewell, you know what, before the race began.
Yeah,
You know, you're supposed to hydrate, but then all that you overhydrate, and then you have to go to the bathroom. Anyway, fond memories of the marathon. I don't think I'm going to be doing a lot of marathons going forward because it's kind of punishing on the body. And besides, my life is a marathon, so why should my spare time should I be?
It is, isn't it?
Yeah,
you've got a lot going on.
I got a lot.
Seeing patients all the time and so forth. Yeah.
So do I need more ordeals? I don't think so. I just like training, biking, swimming, running whenever I get a chance. Okay, so in the news this week, the big story is that guess what? Americans are the fattest people in the world.
No surprise there.
But I think, the statistics were sort of interesting because the world is catching up with us, but there's no country that can hold a candle to America. I think in Japan, I think the obesity rate was something in the low teens. In France, in the low 20s. In the United States, it's, well over one-third. So, by some estimates, over one-half when you factor in people who are not overtly obese, but simply overweight. So, we're doing something wrong, obviously. We're the land of plenty, but we're the land of excess. And, that's why I really think there's a national emergency here. And I think we're the shock troops, you and I and health professionals like us and many of our listeners who are sort of carrying the banner for a healthy lifestyle are sort of the shock troops against a real dangerous epidemic. I watched briefly the Democratic national debates last night, and they said, what is the biggest crisis facing the world now? And, so the different candidates, these are Democratic candidates. So, Bernie Sanders said it's climate change. He said climate change. It's going to annihilate the planet. It's going to, our children, grandchildren won't have a place to live. Okay. Then, other candidates more moderate said, it's the Middle East. It's the threat of nuclear proliferation. Yeah, I wish somebody had stood up and said, I think the biggest crisis that faces America, certainly, is our health crisis. Because this is a crisis that can really undermine our country, our place in the world, can certainly sink our economy under the burden of medical debt. I think that there's room. I mean, look, everybody's got their own hobby horse to ride on, and that's mine. And I think, it's really a national priority that we deal with, and not just with a new either single payer or some more inclusive insurance system.
Care for all,
but a fundamental reorientation of how we approach health in America and some of the other countries. The other fact that came out earlier this week is that by far we're spending more per capita for medical care than any other country in the world, and our results are not as good. Because our life expectancy is good. I mean, it's up in the high 70s, but other countries way surpass us in life expectancy because they have a healthier lifestyle. Not necessarily access to better medicine, more drugs, more surgery, more timely medical intervention. It's not about that ultimately.
It has to be about lifestyle change. It has to be about the foods that we choose to eat. It has to be about how we sleep, how we live our lives, how we approach all of this. So, and that's what's still lacking here.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, hopefully the tides are turning and it will take some time. But, people have their food preferences. They have their food addictions. There are certain things they don't want to give up. And I think that's also a big part of it. And food marketing and the big food, big food industry, all of that plays into why it has become so difficult to change our eating choices, change our eating habits at all. I think that's a large part of it.
And I was just chatting with one of our patients who had recently been to Italy. He's of Italian background. Mm-hmm. And he just described his experience there and how different it was just in terms of how people orient to a meal and how they spend a lot of time, socializing and relaxing. It's unhurried. And I said,
slow food.
Slow food.
Slow food.
And,
yeah.
From many standpoints, Italy is a country that's in trouble. Economically, they're stagnant. They have lots of unemployment. There's lots of social unrest in that country. So there are definitely some disadvantages to kind of a cool down, not white hot economy, which is what mm-hmm. we aspire to in America, real consumer economy. But in some ways, there are quality of life benefits to economies which are not based on geometric growth curve for consumer spending and for basically the expansion of all manner of goods and services that ultimately tempt us into sedentary lifestyle and obesity and a hurried lifestyle, and it's sort of a materialistic lifestyle.
Yeah. But the idea of slow food, taking the time to enjoy a meal. Many European even in France, I think, I remember reading an article just a couple of years ago about school meals and things. The school meal is actually sacrosanct. Mm-hmm. The children are brought into the lunchroom. They are told what's on the menu. They sit and they eat. They get an appropriate amount of time to eat, not at 10:30 in the morning in the 9th or 10th grade or whatever, not inappropriate times. And that's it. No between meals, snack things. I mean, mealtime is sacrosanct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember.
Appropriate time is given to it.
I remember when I lived in France, I lived with a French family. I was their au pair. It's kind of weird to mention. I was a male au pair, but I was there to basically teach the children English and to, do some small household chores. And, the kids would come home from school for lunch. They get a 2-hour lunch break, and they came home. And they had a big, delicious lunch. And the other interesting thing is, these kids were young. These kids were like 10, 12 years old. And they sat at the table, and they gave them a little diluted wine. And I actually think that may be one of the best hedges against alcoholism, is that when you don't make it such a big deal or a forbidden fruit, and you make it just part of the general, gastronomy, as opposed to, I'm going to, do shots and get high. I think that's probably one of the reasons why alcoholism is present in France, but not
that
to the degree
so
that not to the degree here. Yeah, it's a cultural thing.
Yeah. Diluted wine at lunchtime.
Yeah.
Oh boy. So does that mean I can go out to lunch and have, say, a white wine spritzer and then come back to work?
We're going to do a breathalyzer test on you when you come to the office. We don't want you to be impaired when you work with a patient. Besides, it really blows their confidence when they smell the alcohol on your breath. Use some breath mints.
Sweetened with xylitol, please. Yes.
So just as an aside, and then we'll get to questions, I was just talking about broadcasting with some colleagues of mine, and I've been broadcasting now pretty near getting on to 30 years, maybe 28 years now, and a lot of the broadcasting I do, right now I'm broadcasting from my home studio. I'm calling you via Skype in the Hoffman Center office, and we're not face-to-face, but, I sit literally about 20 feet away from a liquor cabinet. And mm-hmm. and I mean, I could be sipping a martini while I do this. And I have to say that during my not good, because I want to devote full concentration and sobriety to every moment that I spend on the air. And I have to say that I got a perfect track record. I have never had a drop of alcohol during my programs. No, I'm just kidding. I've never succumbed to. I have, however, after some tough interviews, I've definitely I've made myself a cocktail after a couple of tough interviews.
Pour yourself a strong one, of
right,
course.
Afterwards, yeah. But
that's appropriate.
Okay, so with you, I never have to have a drink after talking to you. It's like,
I'm so glad.
You should be flattered. Okay, so let's proceed to questions.
Yes. We have a question from Carolyn. Dr. Hoffman, may I ask, do you think ionic foot baths are effective mm-hmm. in helping eliminate toxins from the body? I remember seeing an infomercial or something like that about these ionic foot bath.
I think that the tradition dates back to the New Testament, in which, you know, where Mary Magdalene washed the feet of Christ with her hair, something along those lines. Like, it's sort of a purification ritual. You know, I'm just being facetious there, but there is a purported detoxification technology where you get an ionic foot bath, which it's an electrical system which creates an ionic current, like a battery, through the water. And you add something to the water, and the degree to which the water turns brownish, greenish, brackish has to do with the amount of toxins that it's pulling out of your body. And it's from a visual standpoint, it's really impressive, because you put your feet in the bath and you think your feet are pretty clean, but man, you see that stuff, you know, coming out. It looks like it's coming, you're sucking it right out of your feet. This is a little bit of a trick. It's like a little chemistry class kind of trick, because when you put an ionic solution in water, possibly in the presence of, you know, a little bit of sodium chloride, you know, from your sweat, or from your skin surface, it catalyzes chemical reaction, which turns the water different colors. And it has absolutely nothing to do with you sucking toxins out of your body. It just looks impressive. And some people succumb to this pseudoscience and believe that they're accomplishing something. But there's absolutely no basis to believing that it's doing anything whatsoever.
I'll bet it's the same thing with those foot pads that are reported to do the same thing.
I think that that's a variation on the theme. Yeah, that's a variation on the theme. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a sleight of hand.
Yeah. So, Carolyn, that's not the best way to eliminate toxins from your body.
What are some good ways to really eliminate?
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about eliminating toxins from the body. The master antioxidant that we make endogenously, but we could use some help from, is glutathione. Glutathione helps us to detoxify. And the things that can raise glutathione in our bodies is making sure we have ample amounts of vitamin D, number one. And another way is to take the precursor to glutathione called N-acetylcysteine, or NAC. That's NAC. And, of course, eating a very, very clean diet, not, you know, exposing yourself to toxins in the first place. But for any toxins that have accumulated, being on a very detoxifying, very clean, whole foods, unprocessed foods diet would be a place to start.
Right. Simplistically, you know, we use a model in what we call, we used to call it clinical ecology, now we call it environmental medicine, where people do get toxic burdens, an example of which a patient we recently saw who had ruptured breast implants, and you know, some of the material from that went into her system, and it just slammed her. We also had a patient, I guess it was just yesterday, a patient who said, I'm in trouble, because she's a real estate manager. She was taking care of one of her properties. She went in the basement. She saw that they were cleaning up some old asbestos-covered pipes, and there was a pile of dirt on the floor. So instead of leaving it to the professional asbestos abaters, she broomed it up. Well, she created a cloud of dust, and she got really sick. Not probably from the asbestos, because the asbestos will kill you 20 or 30 years hence. There probably was a lot of mold in that, and she has a history of mold sensitivity, candida sensitivity, and she just got body slammed by that. So those are examples of people who need to detox. Sometimes people who have too much in the way of fish that contains mercury or PCBs, you know, people who take, you know, food that is loaded with, you know, antibiotics, phthalates, preservatives, chemicalized food.
Yeah. So with our exposure to plastics, yes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. BPA from can linings. So we think of this as my cup runneth over. In other words, we all have a cup, and some people have a big cup and some people have a small cup that easily runs over. They have a low capacity for handling toxins. That's why people who live in toxic environment like New York, some people seem robust. Other people are, you know, succumb to chemical hypersensitivity or toxic effects more easily because they just don't have the capacity to handle it. But so the idea is, how do you empty that cup? Well, you look at other ancillary factors. You focus on diet. You help the liver with the pathways that are necessary for detoxification with glutathione, N-acetylcysteine, milk thistle. It's actually, I think it's really a science, detoxification. Sauna is sometimes helpful. This is actually one of the, you know, whatever you think of Scientology as a religion or a cult, L. Ron Hubbard, who's the founder of Scientology, came up with a detoxification protocol using saunas and certain vitamins and, you know, some exercise to liberate the toxins that are locked into your fat cells. And there really is something to that, is that the fat is sort of a repository for toxins. But, you know, we could go on the subject of detoxification. Maybe we should do an entire podcast or maybe a video cast on the subject of detoxification. I think it would be worthwhile.
And different people detoxify at varying degrees of efficiency. Some people are poor detoxifiers.
Yes.
Other people are better. And it has to do with some genetic SNPs sometimes.
Yes.
Other times it has to do with the total
which
body
we can measure, which we can measure now.
About.
We can actually take a look at that now. Yeah. And it sometimes has to do with methylation, which involves B vitamins. Some people's methylation is impaired. Methylation is one of the things that drives a detoxification. So, you know, and how we know that people have different rates of detoxification? Well, you know, go out drinking with a group of people and, you know, just do shots together. And some people will be completely blasted, you know, from the get-go. And other people tolerate large amounts because they have fantastic detoxification. And some of it's acquired and some of it's, you know, because you actually can get used to it. But
you can and become a functional alcoholic or something.
Right. Actually, it turns out that the people who tolerate alcohol the best are at highest risk for alcoholism because they can consume so much before they maintain their seeming balance and composure, but they're really taking in such high levels that they become addicted.
Or they could be trained when they come home from lunch when they're 12 years old, they can have some diluted wine.
Right. Exactly.
Anyway, Carolyn, thank you very much for your question. Okay. Our next question from Jerry. I have a question regarding statin use. My father's 83 years old and diabetic. He takes medication for his blood sugar and his blood pressure. We got him off statins, and he did very well controlling his cholesterol naturally for many years. Now, last year, my mother died last year, and his cholesterol, he was still kind of controlling it, but the reason I'm writing you all this is he had a mild stroke about a week ago, and the doctor told him it was because he was not on statins anymore.
What a crock.
What do you think?
What a crock.
Yeah.
What a crock. What a dishonest crock
that is. What a terrible thing to say.
What a terrible thing to say. First of all, you know, that's so wrong from so many standpoints. Because first of all, I wish I had a buck for everybody who is on a statin drug who gets a stroke. We know that statins may exert some protective effects against strokes and heart attacks. There is no question. I will admit to that. But they're not perfect protection against strokes and heart attacks. We also know that the benefits of statins tend to wane after approximately the age of 70 or 75. And so the downsides...
He's 83. Yeah.
Right, and he's 83. The downsides tend to multiply. We also know that this guy, the context of this guy's stroke is that he was in that critical period where he just lost a spouse, probably a spouse of many, many decades. You know, he might have been celebrating his 50th or 60th anniversary. And we know that that's an enormous blow to the system of, of the surviving spouse. They say that if you can get through the first year past the death of a long-term spouse, you're likely to survive. But that's a critical period. And literally, your blood tends to curdle at those periods. And so, you know, for the doctor to say that is not only erroneous, it's kind of cruel to attribute this guy's stroke, which, you know, can occur in the natural course of things, who knows, to his lack of being on statins. That's just absurd.
Yeah. You know, just looking at this particular case, I'm somewhat bothered by the fact that he's diabetic and he was given a statin. We know that at least in women, statins may cause diabetes.
Right.
I wonder if this could have exacerbated his diabetes.
Right.
I wonder what his homocysteine was. Did anybody bother to look at that? And people in their 80s do better with a higher cholesterol, according to so much older research, but still relevant
yes.
research.
Show me an 83-year-old who has a cholesterol of 120, and I wouldn't issue them a life insurance policy, because that
yeah.
is that shows that they're really at high risk of dying, because their body's
yeah.
not manufacturing enough cholesterol. Cholesterol, beyond a certain age, the higher the cholesterol is, the more protective it might be. The studies actually show that individuals who are octogenarians, nonagenarians, centenarians, they often have very high cholesterols, but correspondingly high HDL cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
oh boy. Hey, you know, but that's a comment, the sad comment on our medical system, that's the,
yeah.
the way that, I mean, the, it, you know, if that's the only way that you think you can forestall a stroke, then no wonder our medical system is in such trouble.
Amen.
All right. That's all the time that we
Jerry,
have for...
Yeah. Yeah. That, yeah. Well, Jerry, we wish you best of luck with your father.
Yeah. But don't feel bad, because, you know, you may feel like, oh, you know, I listen to health shows, I took my father off the statin, now you're going to have a sense of guilt that somehow you induced his stroke. That is really...
Highly unlikely.
Thank you. So that's all the time we have for this part of today's Q&A with Layla. As many of our listeners know, we divide our podcast into two parts, so it's worthwhile for you to get to part two, wherein we'll answer such questions as... Let's tease to part two. What's up?
As at-home allergy testing using blood spot test kits.
Mm-hmm.
Are they accurate?
All right. Coming up in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast, it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We'll be right back.